Hey, JD here. Welcome to the Mead House. You know, over the past several years, we've brought you over 125 episodes of mead making, education, information, and entertainment. More than 80 guests have stopped by the Mead House. Professional mead makers, medal-winning home mead makers, competition organizers, experts on yeast and honey specialists have all visited to share their knowledge. The Mead House is produced to home mead makers and brewers looking for a bit of inspiration and information from the many guests and discussions we have here at the house. You can help support the Mead House by joining the Mead House Keyholder Club on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com and search for the Mead House. There's also a link in the show notes. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a keyholder. We've teamed up with some great companies to provide thank you gifts for your support. So get on over to Patreon, join the Mead House Keyholder Club, and get your own set of keys to the Mead House. Hey, you can listen to the Mead House podcast with your favorite player and be sure to rate us 5 stars on iTunes or your favorite listening venue. The Mead House, mead making entertainment you just don't want to miss. Welcome to the Mead House, and thanks for listening to episode number 144. You know where to find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, iHeartRadio. All those places are all listed on the front page of the website, themeadhouse.com. Hey, you know, the Mead House is produced for home mead makers and brewers just like you and me, looking for a bit of inspiration and information from the many guests and discussions we have here at the house. Talk to us on Facebook and Twitter, both at the Mead House, or you can just simply email us at info@themeadhouse.com. Jeff and Ryan are both in the house. My name is J.D. Webb. In this episode, in 1978, President Jimmy Carter signed H.R. Bill 1337 into law, allowing homebrewers to brew beer greater than 5% ABV and without taxation. 1 year later, our guest began his journey in home brewing, culminating in medal-winning recipes in mead making. Home mead maker Kevin Minsma joins us in this episode. The holidays are coming around, and so we thought we'd spend segment two talking a little bit about ingredients, some of the spices and ingredients that we typically deal with around the holiday season. Maybe you got a wish list or two that you're looking to jot down a few things on Santa's Santa's list. Christmas list. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and then of course we'll break off into segment three with Facebook friends. And we got a special one tonight, all the way from Russia. So all that and more here at the Mead House. But first, thanks to all the Mead House keyholders who help keep the Mead House podcast free. You too can become a Mead House key holder and help. I keep doing this over and over and over, and I keep making the same mistake. Let's get this one going again, cowboy. Thanks to all Mead House key holders who keep the Mead House podcast free. You too can become a Mead House key holder and help support the show for as little as $2 a month. We've got some great thank you gifts to send to you. So get on over to patreon.com, search for Mead House, or click the link in the show notes. What are we drinking here tonight, guys? I usually start these off. I'm double fisting it tonight. I pulled a sample out of my little 3-gallon wooden barrel of the blackberry, or no, I take that back, black currant and plum port mead that I did quite some time ago. Gosh, almost 2 years ago now. I put 3 gallons of it in a fresh, unadulterated oak barrel, never had anything in it before, just rinsed it out with water, made sure it was sealed up good, and then put 3 gallons of this port mead into it and let it set. Well, it's been in there for probably about a good 10 months now, and I think it's about ready to come out. I'm thinking about putting it back into it. I got one 3-gallon, and I got 1 5-gallon glass carboy left, Ryan, and that's it. So I'm going to pull this 3 gallons out, put it back into the 3-gallon. Tasting this, I mean, it's got a nice tartness. The tannins of the barrel have come out really nice. It's an American oak, so it's not one of these Hungarian or French or you know, one of these European oak flavors, but it does have some good tannin to it. I like this. The one thing that is missing, though, this is the one I did with, I fortified with brandy, and I'm just not getting enough of the brandy flavor to come through. So what I think I'm going to do is put it back in a 3-gallon glass carboy and add some more brandy to it and bring it up to a level that I like. In my other fist, this is actually the last bottle. If you know, Saphouse Meadery, if you're not a member of their mead club, you really got to get over there and join. Ash sends out a box, I think it's every quarter, of meads that they produce there at Saphouse. This is the last bottle in my last box. It's called Mind of Enlightenment. And it's raspberry, honeyberry. I have no idea what a honeyberry is. Do you guys know what a honeyberry is? You ever heard of a honeyberry?
Well, yeah. He sent us a honeyberry traditional, the first batch of meads that he sent to the show. It's kind of it's in that kind of serviceberry family, really kind of characteristic honey taste. It's light.
That's right.
I wouldn't know if it would put up well with the tartness of the raspberries, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is raspberry, honeyberry, and blueberry. I get a lot of raspberry. I mean, it's got a really nice raspberry tartness to it. It's a little on the dry side, so it's not anything sweet by any stretch. This has really got a good flavor. I haven't had anything bad out of Saphouse yet. Those guys are on the money. I know that they know what they're doing there. So another good one from Saphouse Meadery, Mind of Enlightenment. Really, really enjoying this. Jeff, what did you put in your glass tonight, bud?
Well, as you mentioned Mind of Enlightenment. I'm actually planning on taking that over to my in-laws for a little bottle share this Thanksgiving here. So figured treat them to something nice. Mm-hmm. Tonight I have two glasses and really contrasty tonight just by accident. I kind of I rushed to get home and get some food in the oven and put a couple of different glasses together. In my first glass, I have pretty tall pour on some some blended scotch that my wife got me for my birthday last year.
Ooh.
That's the Chivas Regal, and it's their Mizunara special edition. I forget exactly how this worked out, but I believe it was using some Japanese oak for the oaking, and this has been a really divisive little pour sample thing for some of my friends that really like scotch. There are some people that just don't care for it. I think it's actually just ridiculously smooth and easy drinking. It's still got that smoky, peaty flavor that I look for in a scotch.
Mm-hmm.
And the pull on it's real nice and smooth. Just real good one for a kind of chilly night tonight.
That sounds good.
And then in my other hand, I broke out a bottle of, I want to say this is 2 or 3 years old. This is a Morat that I made. It's a mulberry mead with mulberries from my own backyard.
Mm.
And I let it go with just a little bit of residual sugar. And of course, you know, scotch on my palate is not helping the flavor profile.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of fruitiness hanging out. And, you know, I think it is starting to kind of to fade and age into something close to like almost like a dry red wine, except with just a little bit more berry kind of notes in the background. If I'm going to do this again, and, you know, we try to save a couple pounds of berries each summer to do another batch, I'm probably going to leave a little bit more sweetness or back sweeten this up a little bit more just to bring out more of that berry notes. But I really like the red wine character to this. It just, it's mellow and it's kind of, that nice tannic notes from the berries. I enjoyed the hell out of this. This was accidentally at the time I made it the best thing I'd ever made, and it's still pretty high up there.
Wow, that sounds good. Sounds really good. Ryan, I know you got a lot going on, and I know you've been digging through the shelf down there in the basement, in the Mead House North basement. What did you pull off the shelf tonight?
Well, I pulled off a nice bottle, but you know, before I get to that, I'll tell you. Now, the last time JD, well, maybe not the last time, one of these times JD gave me a bottle of scotch that he enjoys, knowing that I'm a scotch, I don't know, connoisseur might be too heavy of a word, but a scotch appreciator anyway.
Yeah.
And he gave me a bottle, and it's a little smokier than I usually drink. I switched it up a little bit, and I've been drinking it with a twist, and it's absolutely delicious. And I'm one of those people, yeah, I know some people say, oh my gosh, it's sacrilege, you know, just should just be maybe a couple of drops of water is all you should ever do with your scotch. And that's usually what I do if I've got a bottle I really like or a scotch I really like, but I'm also one of those people who's more pragmatic, and I say, look, the only person you have to impress or please for what's in your cup is yourself.
Yep.
And so if you like your drinks a certain way, go ahead and do it however you like it. And I'm not, you know, embarrassed or ashamed or anything like that to say that I've been drinking that bottle of scotch you gave me just with a twist, and it's absolutely fantastic. Now, you know, I mean, a true twist here, you know, I mean, not the fruit, you know, but just that perfect little twist that you do to kind of burst open the oils out of the peel that come into the whiskey, and it just brightens it up just enough for me to balance out that smoke. And I think it's absolutely fantastic. So
good.
I've been last couple of days, I climbed pretty deep into that bottle. No ordering tonight. I on the cellar room of Mead House North, I pulled off a bottle of a Pyment, and this is a Riesling Pyment to be more specific. I'm blanking on the honey. I don't have my book on me, which is, I'm sadly saying, I've done a few too many times here on the show. But it's a darker honey. Not like a bowl of shade honey or caramelized honey, just a honey that's a little darker in color. And it presents like an orange wine. And when I say an orange wine, yeah, a little orange in hue. But what an orange wine is, which isn't very common, but they're certainly out there, is no, it's not a wine made with Valencia oranges, in case that's what you're thinking. It's a white wine that is fermented on the skins. So typically, you know, red wines are fermented on their skins, and then they're pressed off the skins.
Yep.
White wines are typically pressed off the skins before they're fermented, or very, you know, before they're fermented, and then a rosé is oftentimes maybe fermented for a little bit on the skins and then pressed off. But an orange wine is a white wine that is fermented on its skins, more like a lot of red wines are, and it gives it, the skins give it this darker hue. They're fairly rare, and you can find them at liquor stores, I suppose, but they're a little bit more rare. And so they're darker in color. They're not that straw color of, say, a lot of the white wines. And that's what this is presenting as. It was not fermented on any skins at all. It's got a very perfumey bouquet and a little bit of that Riesling sweetness. Now, I like dry Rieslings personally. I love Rieslings, but I drink them dry, and they're absolutely delicious. And this one is on the drier side, but I did... it's giving some perceptions of sweetness, which come off really well, even though it does gravity reading, which looked pretty dry. So it's I guess I'd call it balanced. It's and I really am enjoying this one. It was a fun find on the rack.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Yeah. So joining us tonight, as JD mentioned, is our good friend Kevin, who started brewing in, it says, the year after Jimmy Carter made home brewing legal. So if you follow the math on this, Jimmy Carter signed the law in 1978. The law didn't take effect until 79. So depending on when you're counting, that would have said, that would mean that Kevin either started brewing in 79 or 80, depending on a year from signing the law or a year from the law becoming into effect. So it's been a while, let's put it that way. A colleague introduced him as a hobby, and he spent 6 years making extract beer. And back then, extract isn't what it is now, I'll tell you that. Not that I was making beer back in 1980, but just the trajectory, I've seen the quality of extracts go lately, and what I used to hear back then, extract beers weren't what they are now. He stopped for a while while his kids were growing up and resumed the hobby about 11 years ago, making a few more extract batches before going over to all grain. He began making mead 2 years ago with immediate success, winning second place for his Melomel at the 2018 AHA Nationals final round, which is with his very first Sizer. I'm sorry, Fruit Mead. So he won his Fruit Mead with a Sizer. He's won several best in shows. He's done very good at the Major Cup over the years. He's also a very good winemaker, making wines from California and Washington grapes. He's a great brewer, I'll tell you that. So like I said earlier, I think he's one of those guys that just has the magic fermentation touch. Cause I think he's I've had his beers, ciders, wines, and mead, and they've all been fantastic. He loves the hobby because it blends creativity and science, putting all of that together. And Kevin was one of the illustrious folks that put on the Valkyrie's Horn competition earlier this year. Welcome to the show, Kevin. What's in your cup tonight?
Well, thanks for having me. In your tradition, I have two things in front of me here. One of them actually is a mead that was entered at the Valkyrie's Horn, and it's a tropical mead. It's petalant, about 7 or 8% alcohol, and it's made with pineapple, mango, peach, and strawberry.
Oh, dude.
And it has the most incredible aroma. This thing just bleeds pineapple. And then it's got this nice little strawberry supporting background note, and it's a lot of fun to drink, and I don't think we're going to be able to hang on to any of it through Thanksgiving.
We need to stop right here. I'm telling, I was at Valkyrie's Horn, and at the after parties, I had some of Kevin's offerings. Dude, you got me going here now, man.
Good.
Oh my God, tropical pineapple. Oh, geez, dude. I mean,
so this was an experiment. I actually made this 2 weeks before Valkyrie's Horn.
Oh man,
and it ended up taking second place in the fruit mead category as a session mead.
Wow.
So I was pretty happy with that. That was kind of the experiment. I actually utilized Kvike Hornendahl,
yes,
which was the first time that I had used that yeast. And, you know, I had been hearing that people were using it at high temps. So I pushed it to 105 degrees.
Yes.
And it fermented to terminal gravity in 24 hours.
There you go.
So yeah. I played it, carved it, packaged it, and sent it in.
We need to be the national spokesman for...
It's great stuff. I actually have two other meads going with that right now.
Oh my god.
And I just made
man, if we had a nickel for every person that tried Fike from listening to this podcast, though.
Oh my god! Yeah.
Well, it's the hot yeast these days, isn't it?
It is.
They're literally the hot yeast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pun intended. Yeah, and then the other beverage I have here, actually, I did kind of with JD in mind. After chatting with you at Valkyrie's Horn at the after party. I heard about how you like coffee meads, and of course you had some of that avocado that I did with habanero
and
chipotle.
Yes.
So
very good.
I have to finish up the session here, I have an avocado mead, or avocado honey mead, I should say more accurately. And I have cold pressed espresso on this mead.
Okay.
And it's good. It's really clean and smooth.
we got
these nice coffee, kind of chocolatey flavors from the avocado play really well with that, you know, rich espresso flavor.
Okay, obviously we're going to get into that later on, Ryan, during our interview here.
Yeah. You know, talking about some of the meads, Kevin, one of the meads that I had of yours at Valkyrie's Horn was your lime coconut, and I know, unfortunately, the judges might have scored other meads higher, but man, that you talk about a mead that you want to just put on tap at your summer barbecue or just any time in the summer. That is one. That is absolutely fantastic. I want to hear a little bit about how you approach the lime and the coconut as you were constructing that mead.
Okay. I actually made that mead to bring to the American Homebrewers Conference out in Providence. So the AMMA had a booth out there, and so I made this as a session mead. It was about maybe 7%, which, you know, to me doesn't sound like a session beverage since I'm a home brewer of beer probably first, but in the mead world it certainly is. So, yeah, I wanted to make something kind of light, refreshing, and different. So that's how I settled on lime and coconut, and of course everybody loves that phrase, you know, and there's mm-hmm. the song, the whole deal. So for the coconut, and that the coconut turned out to be a good deal more effort than I anticipated. I've used coconut when I've made beer in the past, and it hasn't been any problem, partly because you do a little bit of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
With mead, though, I'm not heating it. And so I followed my standard procedure with coconut. I bought, I don't care if it's organic or not, it just happened to be my source. It was organic coconut. And I'm using the shavings. They're like a real big flake.
Yeah.
Not like the shredded stuff that you put on your pie, right?
Yeah.
And so I get out a great big cookie sheet, and I spread it on a thin layer and stick it in the oven at about 150 to 175 degrees, and I toast it.
Yeah.
So that adds some really nice character to the coconut, and it also helps to remove a little bit of the oils that are in the coconut flakes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put that into the must and let it ferment, I added juice from, I think, 3 or 4 small limes. I can't tell you the variety. They were just whatever was available in the store. And then I zested the limes and kept that out separate in a bag, which I tossed in the freezer until the mead was finished. So I let that ferment, and of course, you know, I punch it down because the coconut floats up as the carbonation starts. And I ended up having to skim off the oil from the coconut about 3 to 4 times over the course of several days. Because as it created alcohol, it started pulling oil out of the coconut. So that was an interesting experience.
How did you, would you, your fermentation temperatures cold enough to coagulate the oil, or was it just like a Exxon Valdez slick on the top of the?
No, it was pretty well coagulated. Yeah. It looked a little like cottage cheese.
Okay.
And the coconut was baked, so it wasn't like I was skimming coconut flakes off the top either. You know, it was just the oil. And I think, you know, because this was back in the spring, I made it like a month before the AHA event, which was in June. So I made it back probably in, you know, May. I'm fermenting in my basement at ambient, which at that time of the year is probably around 62 to 64 degrees.
Yeah, okay.
So it's cold enough for that oil to solidify. Yeah. I did, though, after fermentation was complete, I added another pound of coconut in secondary because I didn't feel like the coconut flavor was strong enough. The lime had kind of taken over. And then once that had a chance to sit on the mead for about a week, I added the lime zest in a bag and let that sit for a few days and then pulled the whole works out and let it clear.
Well, it was fantastic, and I, for being made in May, you know, it that the coconut held up, which is, I know, pretty tough to do. I've had a lot of coconut beers and braggots where that coconut falls out rather quickly, which is, you know, had me playing with some other types of coconut flavorings to try to retain it. But man, that was good. Sign me up for a keg of that next summer, and and I'll probably ask you for a second one. But it was very good. Before we get too far down, JD, did you want to, should we talk about the coffee mead?
Yeah, should we? That's like dangerous territory around the mead house, Kevin. I don't know if you've listened to some previous shows here. Coffee is like one of the big no-nos around here. Anyway, yeah, the coffee thing. I'm always curious. I've had a couple of pretty good, you know, pretty good coffee meads. And I'm always skeptical because of our own experiments that we did here. I think the guys here at the house, we probably spent a couple of months working on different projects involving coffee of one variety or another and in some format or another, whether it was cold brew, hot brew, coffee beans, what have you. And, you know, I think I came up with one that was more Kahlua-like than anything that I thought was pretty good. Ryan and Jeff both came up with a couple of iterations I think they thought was pretty good. But how did you, you say you use espresso. That's a pretty rich coffee.
It is, and that's why I chose it.
Yeah. How did you, without having tasted it, of course, is it a light coffee flavor, or do you have that really punch out espresso flavor in the mead, or how did you work this all out?
Well, so I just did this as a blending exercise today, just to play with it, because this is something that's been on my list for a long time. I wanted to do something kind of fun just for this event, this show. So I worked with coffee and beer quite a bit and had really, really good success with it. So I've got a pretty good idea how to handle coffee in brewed alcoholic beverages. I've also judged quite a few coffee beers, and I can tell you from that experience that I've learned that there are things you should not do. So that helps guide my effort a little bit. What I did, well, I had the mead already, and it's a pretty strong, powerful mead. It's this avocado honey, which is pretty rich. It's rich, got coffee notes. It's got some caramel, a little bit of background chocolate, and this particular mead has enough alcohol that diluting it with the coffee isn't going to be a problem. So that's another thing that I think is important for people to consider when they're going to be working with coffee, is if you're going to add it post-fermentation, which is the only way I will add coffee. Yeah, always post-fermentation. When you add it during fermentation, my experience is that you end up with green pepper flavors. Some people think that that's from bad coffee, and I don't have a definitive answer. I don't know whether that's actually true or false, but my observation is that if you add it during fermentation, there's something that the yeast does to the coffee flavor that produces these kind of unexpected and rather unpleasant green pepper flavors in a coffee beer or mead, I suppose. So I don't add it during fermentation anymore. I only do it post-fermentation. That tends to then preserve the coffee flavor. But you also then have to plan your mead or your beer with that addition and the volume that you intend to put in mind.
Yeah, okay.
So if you're going to add a half gallon, you want to take that into account if you're making a stout, for instance. Or in this case, because it's about a 17% ABV mead, the dilution isn't really a problem.
Yeah.
Now, if I would have had a little more warning about this chat, I would have had an opportunity to send you a bottle, but we'll have to reserve that for another day.
That's Ryan's fault.
I'm not placing blame.
I am.
Along that line at all. I just didn't have a lot of warnings, so I couldn't get you one.
That's okay. I'll give you my address after the show. How did you, the espresso coffee, was it coffee beans instant?
It's ground.
Okay.
So I happen to be fortunate enough to have a good friend who owns 5 Dunn Brother coffee shops.
Oh, good. Okay.
And he is one of my best consumers of beer.
Ah.
I can't drink it all. I make too much. So sure. He will bring me espresso when I want it.
Okay.
So he brings me, the pressed. They do their own cold press there, and he just brings me, a half gallon of it at a time, and I use it as I need to.
I see. Okay.
But I've made cold press myself, and it's not hard. The method I used was take a 2-gallon plastic bucket, get a couple of pounds of ground beans, and use some RO water, put 1.5 gallons of water in on the beans and let it sit for 24 hours in the fridge and then press it.
Do you think the RO water makes a difference?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Why is that? The minerals you think have a big impact on? Yeah.
I think they do. I think, my water here where I live is really, really hard. You can't use it for brewing.
Okay.
And it changes the character of the coffee. So I prefer to not use it.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Guys, I don't know, the coffee thing. the way Kevin's approaching this, this is one thing that I haven't tried. I mean, I've done the put the beans in the fermentation. I've done the secondary thing, but the thing that I haven't done is brewed just a straight up traditional and then blended the coffee in after the fact. And that may be, if I do anything with coffee here in the future, and just might, talking with Kevin, just might, I'll do a small batch, maybe a gallon batch just to start out with. And play with it, but I think he might be on to something here, Jeff. That was for Jeff. Turn the mic on, Jeff.
Sorry about that. I keep going back and forth on the coffee thing, and you know, like I've said time and time again, I know I'm going to hit it sometime or another, and I think the gallon size batch is definitely the size that I'm going to aim for a start until I kind of nailed down a process I like. I like the idea of adding in secondary and adding the flavor. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of playing with some other notions with the coffee and, you know, cold pressing it too. I think Kevin is onto something here with the avocado and the coffee flavor profiles together too. That avocado honey makes a nice rich bold mead that I think would play real nicely with the coffee.
Yeah. I've been thinking about a Bochet or, you know, some melter honey,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little cocoa nibs or something like that in there with the coffee as well.
Yeah, that would sound good too. Yeah. Let's get into this Cavite thing a little bit. You know, it was a while back. I don't remember how many shows ago it was. I should probably put a little spreadsheet together or whatever to remind me, but it was a number of shows ago. We had Omega Yeast on as our guest and talking about the various yeasts that they make. Basically they're all beer yeast. But there was some interest in doing meads with several of their strains. And one of them, of course, was this Cavite, the Hornadal out of Omega. And so, Ryan, I think each one of us, Jeff, haven't we all done, I think we've all done the Cavite, the Hornadal, and putting a mead together. Yeah. And, dude, I mean, this is like, I mean, you know, for, and we talked about this before, Kevin, on a show specifically for people who live in the Midwest, or the Southwest, actually, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California, where temperatures get, you know, just out of whack sometimes, and people may not have, a method of cooling, an efficient method of cooling. So, well, what if you could come up with a yeast that didn't have to rely on it? And we each tried this Cavite yeast and were just completely blown away by the end product. Give us your take on how you approach your project using your Cavite, and what your would you recommend that for mead makers to try?
Well, absolutely I would. Like I said, I've got this one that I'm drinking right now, and I've got a couple more underway with it. So, yes, it's rapidly becoming the yeast that I will go to over and over again. Temp control is a big deal, you know, for brewing beer, cider, mead, wine.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. The question is, how do you control the temp for your locality, right?
Right.
Well, I live in a cold climate, but it gets plenty warm in the summer. And my approach to this, at least from a temp control standpoint, because I wanted to push this yeast well outside of the normal range that most people ferment in, I ran it at 105, and it worked great. But we don't have 105 degree temperatures here ambient under very many circumstances. So I came up with a really simple, inexpensive, and elegant solution a number of years ago that I use with my wine, because our red wines are fermented at about 85 to 90 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do is I go to the giant hardware store where you can buy these big black tubs that hold 25 to 30 gallons. They have a yellow top on them, right?
Yeah,
probably, you know, I buy a couple of those. I use a plastic bucket for this kind of fermentation because quite often I'm going to be using this yeast with fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put my 5 or 6 gallon bucket down inside that tub. and I'll fill the tub about half to three quarters full of water.
Right.
It's just sitting on the floor in my basement. And then in my climate, you can buy these roof heating coils to keep ice dams from forming on your house.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I buy one of those, about a 50-footer or so, and I put a temp controller in the water, and I attach that heating coil, and then I wrap it around the fermenter so it's submerged in the water. And the temp controller sits there and switches that heating coil on and off to keep the temperature at a steady state.
Yeah.
So basically for $50, you have total temp control. It's a lot easier to add heat than it is to cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
So that's what I... Yeah, what I like about that yeast is that it ferments pretty clean at just about any temperature, but there are some ways to push it if you want to bring out some more of, say, the citrus, orange or things like that, esters from it. Josh Mahoney made a very good cherry melomel with it. I don't know if it's that strain, but with Quebec yeast. And I've done a lot of stuff with it. We've got a lot of traditionals with it, but we've gone beyond. Now, I don't think it's a Quebec yeast, but I am playing right now with the Lithuanian farmhouse strain from Omega. And I've done a couple of things with that. I've done a Braggot with it. I've done a Melomel with it. And I've done a traditional with it. And I think it like I said, it's not a Kvike. You got to be more temperature sensitive. It flocculates much better than the Kvikes that I've played with. But I also really kind of like that one as well. I think you can get fairly hot with it too. But Kevin, before we get too far down, the other thing I wanted to ask you was, like I said, you do everything. You kind of make the beer, cider, mead, wine, everything else. It's just within the last month or 6 weeks or so, we've gotten the apple juice, the cider juice, and we've got the grape juice or the grapes. What are you making right now with the fresh apple juice you got and the fresh grapes that you picked up from Sizers and Piments and wines and ciders and so forth?
Well, that's a fair question. So I make wine with a friend of mine who lives nearby. And so we made 60 gallons of wine that primarily came from Washington State. That's a new one for us. We've been getting our grapes from California. But we got Zinfandel from Lodi, California. Mm-hmm. And we got Petit Sirah, Merlot, Suzhou, and Cabernet from Washington State this year. So those are all finished. I mean, not truly finished, but they're all done with fermentation. We racked them into glass, and they're now sitting and clearing, and then we're going to be making decisions about oaking, et cetera, here in another week. And out of some of that volume, I have a couple of Piments going. And then in addition, I bought some Sangiovese grapes, and I made a Piment out of that, and that one's really going to be good, I think. I'm really, really liking how that's turned out. And then in addition, I think, you're involved in some of the clubs here in the Minneapolis area, Ryan, and I've participated with one of the clubs where we do a crush and a press for apples that are sourced by one of the members who travels around. He's a salesman, so he travels around and sources apples for us. And I think we crushed and pressed 3,000 pounds of apples.
Holy cow.
Yeah, wow. It's a job.
Wow.
It's a job.
Wow.
He's got good equipment, and I brought some of my stuff. But I ended up with about 15 gallons of really high-quality cider from that. And then one of the other clubs I'm in, I think I got another 10 gallons of apple cider from that purchase, some of which I am concentrating to make an ice cider. That was something I did for the first time last year, and it produced some really spectacular results. Ended up making it into the very final round at Nationals this year. And so I really want to do another one. They're quite delicious. They're a lot of work, but they're very, very delicious. So I've got that going. I've got two sizers going with two different sets of apple sizer. And I've got a New England cider going. Let's see what else. I just started a giant hydromel berry bomb today. So, yeah, I've got a few projects going.
You think?
Well, you know, Kevin, JD started the show by talking about his barrel. You've also done some work with barrels, you know, different collaborations or partnerships with other mead makers. Tell us about your experience with barrels and what you've learned.
Okay, well, I've done a fair number of barrel projects as a home brewer, I think. I started with a club about 5 or 6 years ago. We bought a couple of 53-gallon barrels, and we did a Russian Imperial Stout in there, which turned out just amazing. I actually still have a couple of bottles from that are almost 6 or 7 years old now. And since then, I've purchased a couple of barrels for myself. I bought a barrel from Black Swan, which had honey aged in it for a year. And then I dropped a cider in it. And that, I would love to find another barrel like that. It did some really, really good things for that cider. Just amazing. You know, you pick up the honey, you get, it was a rye whiskey barrel that had been utilized once, and so I picked up a little bit of the rye, the wood, the cider. It just it made it really complex and interesting. And then the last couple of years, I got together with a couple of local mead makers back when I was, you know, I just started this part of the hobby about 2 years ago, and I wanted to do some things with people that really knew what they were doing, because I like to get my process down before I start getting all wild about it. So I had invited Pat McNeely and Al Boyce to join me on a little collaboration project. We made an orange blossom traditional, and we aged it in a rum barrel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That was a good combo. I still have some of that, and it's actually, I won't enter it in competitions because I don't want to give any up.
No, yeah, save it.
I share it, I bring it, and I give it to people that I think can appreciate it, but I'm not sending it to any competitions. And we then went on for a second use in that barrel where we made the same two guys with me, made a traditional Zambian. So this was the Zambian wildflower that we got through the American Mead Makers Association. We aged that in the rum barrel for almost 9 months. And that
is that the
really
one, it didn't, was it you or Al that had a bottle of that at the, I remember somebody yeah, talking about a Zambian mead at one of the after parties. Was that you or Al?
Yeah,
Boys?
That would have been Al.
Oh my God, that was so good.
Yeah, that turned out really nice. And then Al didn't want to get in on a third round, so he dropped out. And I wanted to do something different. And, you know, Ryan talks about braggots all the time.
Yep.
And I have not made a lot of braggots. I've made, you know, one or two now over the last couple of years. And I, you know, they've been okay, but I haven't really been all that thrilled about them. So Pat McNeely and I decided we were going to do a braggot in that same barrel after all these other things were in there. I thought, you know, we could pick up some interesting flavors from what had been done before.
Yeah.
So I built a beer recipe that was focused heavily on caramel malt. And then we took some honey that I had and we caramelized it and added that to the beer as we were finishing the beer process, and then that's in the barrel now.
Wow.
So that's one of the barrels I have here going, and then I have three other barrels, and these are all 15-gallon barrels that I'm doing a project with one of my club groups, and we have three sours going in there.
Wow. Well, Kevin, the time has just flown by having you on here. We appreciate you giving us so much time. Jeff, do you have any last questions for Kevin before we let him get on with his evening?
Sure, sure. You mentioned a Sangiovese Piemont that you put together, and I know I think I got to try a Sangiovese Piemont that you had at the Valkyrie's Horn as well. I've kind of been thinking about playing more with Piemonts lately and was wondering, do you have any tips for people that are maybe not as versed in the winemaking field when getting started with making Piemonts?
Okay, well, the Sangiovese you had was probably from Al Boyce.
Yes. And,
Okay.
I remember that one too. Yeah.
Yeah. He made a really nice Sangiovese Piemont. It's awesome. So I've made two or three Piemonts, I think. My first Piemont, was a blend of red grapes. The second one though, and this one I'm really, really, really fond of. It took a gold medal at Mazer. It took a gold medal at Mash Out, gold medal at the State Fair. I mean, it's been really solid. And if you can ever get your hands on this stuff, I highly recommend it. Orange Muscat.
Orange Muscat.
Yeah. It's one of the grandfather grapes for Vinifera, which is the southern climate grapes that are grown all over Europe. And it's... If you get your hands on this stuff, it's got a little bit of that orange color, which was one of the things that Ryan was talking about earlier.
Okay.
And it's just got this really lovely, distinctive character, and it pairs extremely well with orange blossom honey. I make my Piemonts by adding the grape juice directly to the honey and fermenting both together. A lot of mead makers that I've talked to don't do that. They prefer to make a mead, prefer to make a wine, and then blend them together because that gives them more control over the process. And I won't argue that point at all. I think it's true. But I also tend to believe from my own personal experience that putting them together allows the flavors to meld and integrate in a different way than blending does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my personal preference. It's a little tougher to do, I suspect, but I've never done it any other way, so it's what I do. I think temp control, again, is really important, and picking a good yeast. So if you're going to make a red Piemont, RC212 is a really good choice for red Piemonts. It's got good color stability. It brings out nice berry characters. It's very flexible. It's a workhorse. Nice. For the whites, I've used 71B and DV10, but there's lots of good choices. So pick a good yeast, and then make sure you use pre-fermentation tannin products and add tannin and acid as needed once it's completed.
Sure. Okay.
Excellent. Well, Kevin, thank you again so much. This time has just flown by, and we're over. But yes, thank you again. We'd love to have you back on. And man, I can't wait till the next time when I can try some more of your stuff.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for having me, guys. It's been a pleasure.
You give me cause to come back up to Minnesota, Kevin.
Well, that sounds good. Look forward to it.
All right, buddy. Thanks for joining us tonight, man.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Wow. holy cow, guys. You know, the stuff that he, some of the things that he brought to the Valkyrie's Horn up there, just between him and Al Boy, some of the most amazing tasting meads that I've ever had. And, you know, these guys, I don't know what it is about home mead makers that are really into, they put so much effort and they're so passionate. Maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's more about the passion than anything else. Not that they're perfectionists, but they're willing to push the button a little bit and take it to the next level. I mean, and they're not afraid to try. And I think that sets them apart from a lot of people who just get into it, just say, well, you know, let's make some mead today. These guys are the people who are putting mead on the front burner. You know, we're going to talk about it here in the next segment a little bit. When, you know, when we get into about, you know, talk about introducing people to mead and whatnot over the holidays. But what great stuff that Kevin's doing.
And, you know, we didn't even touch on that Capsimel that he had brought to the after party, too.
Yeah.
Man, that was good.
Yeah, good stuff. Segment two, guys, holiday brewing ideas. We'll just briefly go through some of this because we've got a pretty special Facebook friend. We might get to a couple of them, but I've got one that came in an email that I really want to get to before the end of the show. Holiday brewing ideas, ingredients, spices, that kind of thing. Maybe even a Christmas wish list or two. Ryan, Black Friday, dude. I mean, isn't this what every shopper waits for? I guess, I don't know. I stay home.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, this isn't meant to be a, here's our favorite deals, or here's what you should be looking out for on Friday or
no.
Cyber Monday or Small Business Saturday, because I haven't done any of the research, because that's just not what I want to do. But it is that time of year where I'm sure your local homebrew shop or you know, some of the larger online homebrew shops or a lot of the ingredient places that we talk about. And I don't know, frankly, I don't know if the Mountain Rose Herbs or Amaretti, if they're going to have some sort of a deal, but it's always a good time to think about what you want to play with and what you're looking for. I know that Kevin, you know, I was talking about using all that coconut and having to skim off the oil. I mean,
Yeah. Think
of that. Think of sitting in front of your bucket skimming off coconut, you know, oil. And I mean, it was first of all, it's a fantastic mead. So, I mean, what he did turned out. But I've had enough really high quality other products, you know, like compounds and extracts and things like that, that
yeah.
That's the direction I'm going, and I'll tell Kevin that too the next time I see him, that, you know, he makes that for me next summer. just try some Amaretti extract or something, or some you know, Cascade, you know, coconut syrup or something, that you know, to get those flavors in there. But
yeah,
I digress a little bit. It also might be a great place. There's a couple of liquor stores around here that have really good, like, Black Friday and Small Business Saturday deals. You can pick up some mead on a good discount. I don't know. I just
No,
yeah,
that's
people are thinking about shopping, you know. So I, that yeah. is, you know, just touch on it.
I've ordered I've ordered from several online stores all across the country, actually. A little local home brew stores, actually. And of course, I mean, you know, once you do that, you put your email address in there, so then you start getting emails from them every time they have a sale or whatnot. Here lately, I've been inundated with emails from all these places that I've done business with. I don't mind them so much because it's stuff that I'm interested in, you know, and I'll look through them and, you know, if they got a deal, fine. If they don't, that's fine too. But you know, here lately, like I said, I've been getting quite a few of them, some of them have some pretty good sales going on. You know, I mean, if you're looking for equipment, you want to start, like I did, replacing glass carboys with kegs. A few places out there having pretty good deals on keg purchases. Some of them.
Funny
you
mentioned that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm risking getting in trouble with the wife because I treated myself a little bit. I went on, like you mentioned, you do business with a couple of these guys and they send you their promos and stuff. Austin Homebrew Supply, where I sourced yep. my barrel from, they sent me an email saying, hey, you know, we're doing Black Friday sales. Come check out our deals. And I had some time to kill at work. They had a 1.75 gallon keg.
Oh yeah,
ball lock, and you know I've been thinking about this for a long time. Probably I want to say at least 6 months, because I do 1 gallon batches still, and yeah. it's really frustrating to try and get a way to force carbonate
a one gallon batch
yeah. in a 5 gallon keg.
Yeah,
because I usually that means I have to empty a keg first,
right?
And so. You know, they had a 1.75 gallon brand new ball lock keg for $75.
That's not bad.
I forget exactly how big of a discount, but it was a pretty sizable discount and free shipping. So I said, you know what, I'm gonna treat myself. That's kind of what I need to move forward and do more force carving on these 1 gallon batches that I would love to do, because you know we're doing a lot more of these session strength meats these days. And you know, I just think they taste better carbonated. And I lack Ryan's patience to do the bottle conditioning.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm in a bigger hurry than that. Yeah, no, you're right. Like I said, I mean, I get these emails from a lot of the places that I've done business with. I mean, that's a great way to do your shopping too. I mean, they appreciate repeat customers. If mm-hmm. you've, done well by them, then, hey, you know, return the favor and, shop there again. And, you're helping to keep them in business too, which is a big thing,
in
this hobby.
I'm glad you said that, JD, because I've seen a handful of local homebrew shops, locally owned, mom and pop homebrew shops go out of business in the last year.
Yeah.
Including just one not far from me, just north of Minneapolis, just a little bit. And there's a lot of reasons that can happen. I'm not trying to diagnose something or anything like that. Because I don't know. I mean, I'm not the guy looking at their books. I've seen, like I said, I've seen a lot of that lately. And, it is. I think that sometimes you lose part of the brewing community when that happens. Number one, I think competition's a good thing, and when if there's a lot of these places around. And also, a lot of the local ones are the ones that are supporting the local homebrew clubs, the local competitions. They're the guys that are throwing in gift cards or throwing in, a kettle or something like that, or giving people a place to meet. For their clubs, or a drop-off point for you know, the cider buy or something like that. So, you know, I've put a big focus on that, not just in buying for home brewing, but in purchasing in general. You know, I try to spend my money where it can do the most good. And, you know, I'm not gonna preach here or get off, you know, or climb up on too high of a horse or anything like that, because I, you know, get bucked off in a hurry. But, you know, it is sometimes that little bit of that mindset of saying, you know, we've been ingrained, you know, a lot of times to find the best deal, pay the least, get the most. And frankly, sometimes if you're working with a small mom and pop homebrew shop or a small, you know, mom and pop apiary buying your honey from them, or a small business that you're buying any other ingredients from, or even if you're, you know, like our good friend Chrissy, you know, who's on the show, Chrissy Mannion's Are Poor. You know, her big thing is, you know, farming. She owns like a farm where you can buy
organic,
like grass-fed beef and, you know, literally free-range chickens and stuff like that. And you know, you're gonna pay a lot more per pound for that, you know, chicken or that beef than you are at, you know, a major supermarket. But it's what you're getting and who you're supporting and that kind of thing. So again, I this isn't meant to be preachy, and I kind of fear it might be becoming that way. But it's your dollars count a lot, and they matter. And, you know, sometimes you say that, you know, oh, how much does, you know, my couple of bucks matter, or, you know, where I buy, you know, a few more pounds of honey, or you know, some malt, or some berries, or, you know, whatever that is. No, most people are more powerful than they realize, and you are. Your wallet, even if you're going to go buy a gallon of honey or something, the difference between that local mom and pop apiary and the big box one, you know, can make a big difference. So just say, keep that in mind, you know, realize, you know, understand that, and then make good mead.
And again, not to jump on the preachy bandwagon here, but to kind of dovetail what Ryan was saying, especially when it comes to your local homebrew store, the guys that own and run these things have been in the homebrew community for probably, you know, years, if not straight up decades. You know, they have their own passion for this hobby, and they go out of their way to make learning and improving your craft, you know, a priority for them.
Well,
I mean, getting even to work part-time at a homebrew store like I do, probably at least once a month, somebody comes in with a sample and says, "Oh, well, how can I make this better?" And That's just something we will taste and give them some free advice. You don't get that if you know, save a couple bucks and buy from an online store that offers everything from A to Z.
Yeah. Well, the flip side of this whole thing too is the fact that you know, how far do you have to go, okay, before you have to resort to an online store? I mean, how far do you have to go out of your way? I mean, how far is the closest local homebrew store? I'm fortunate because I got three of them within about a 25-mile radius. You know, one is closer than the other two I frequent the most. But I'll go there before I, you know, make a purchase online if I can help it, you know. So besides that, I mean, I'm just an old geezer from Colorado. I grew up in a country town, Fort Collins, cattle town, ranching town. I mean, I saw the downtown area dry up when the big box stores came to town. I'm all about supporting the local home businesses. These people get their bread and butter, from the locals. So I'm all for supporting them. Let's talk a little bit about some holiday brewing ideas here. Some of the typical things that I'm thinking about, of course, is ciders, sizers. I'm thinking brown sugars. I'm thinking nutmeg, cinnamons, allspice. I'm thinking all of these classic flavors. I mean, marshmallows on top of sweet potatoes. I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm going to say this. I'm thinking about pumpkin pie. Oh my God, I can't believe I said that. So I'm thinking about all these different flavors and whatnot. Have you guys given any thought to putting something together? If you're using the Kavik yeast, you got plenty of time, to put something together for a Christmas dinner. But when we get done with that, we'll go around the horn here. And when we get done with that, Ryan, about introducing people to mead, this is a great time of year to do that. So, Jeff. Holiday brewing ideas. You got anything in mind that you want to do, or anything on the list?
I've already talked about how I've got some cranberry going, just a light session cranberry mead on some Kvik yeast. I'm not going to have it carbonated in time for Thursday, but I'm planning on having that. Cleared, and I've got a couple different tinctures started with some rosemary and some sage that I'm going to use to pep that up a little bit. So I'm hopefully going to have that nice and cleared and carbonated in time for Christmas here for all those different Christmas dinners and things we'll be going to. The other thought I had, though, and I don't know if you guys have had one of these like in recent memory, but have you guys ever had like the old-fashioned? And I know this is such a heavy negative term, but the old fashioned kind of fruitcake, like somebody actually made in their house.
Yes.
And soaked with like rum or brandy.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. All those, the stone fruits, like the raisins and the prunes and the plums and the dates.
Yes.
You get some of the allspice and the, nutmeg and the cinnamon in there, and then some of that brandy and rum flavor, just we were talking about with Paul, with the port mead, just kind of just fortifying it with some of those liquors. I think that could be real special. I think I've missed the mark for getting that for Christmas time, even with cake yeast this year, but maybe next fall I'll be thinking ahead and start nice dessert style fruitcake mead with a bunch of fruit flavor and some of those spices and some liquor backbone to it. I think that could be real nice.
I'm just an old geezer, y'all know that, but I am an old geezer that I love fruitcake. I love a good liquor soaked fruitcake. I love it so much that I used to make it about every other year or so, because it's a long involved project. But I used to.
Start that in October alcohol and add it and add it.
Yeah. Oh no, I would start in like June. Okay, I would get. Oh yeah, absolutely. Get my fruitcake started in June, and then I would make different iterations using different combinations of fruit, different sugars, and then soak them in different liquors: rum, cognac, brandies. I had a whole recipe, list of fruitcakes going, and then would send them to work with my wife, and pretty soon people would come back and she would have lists of people who want me to bake them up fruitcakes. I haven't done it for so long now, but absolutely, dude, I am up your alley with that. Ryan, holiday brewing ideas. I named off a bunch of spices that I really like to bake and cook and everything with. I've toyed around with a couple of meads using some spices. I've got a pumpkin beer that I'm still sucking on that I made a couple of years ago. It seems to be getting a little bit better with age. It was basically a stout based pumpkin like beer. It actually isn't bad now. It wasn't so good in the beginning, but it's getting better. Any ideas from Mead House North as far as holiday brewing, something that we can throw together in the fermenter and have ready by Christmas?
No, that's a good question. I really think that it depends on what you're going for. And, you know, are you looking for something to go complement a specific meal? You know, I mean, a lot of people, Thanksgiving, it's a pretty good given. You know, you're probably going to have turkey, right?
Yeah.
You know? But at Christmas, you know, some people do a turkey again. Some people do
roast beef,
a ham.
Yep.
You know, some people do a goose. Some people do a roast. We will do steak. Some people, you know, do a seafood, lobster, you know, crab legs, you know, whatever it might be. I think last couple of Christmases are they'll do ethnic food, you know, whatever their heritage is. So Italian food or Lebanese food or Norwegian food, you know, whatever that kind of thing, you know, whatever traditions that their family might have brought from the old country or Mexican or Colombian or, you know, whatever it might be. I think you kind of think about that. I know last few Christmases here, we've done like steak, like filet mignon, you know, or something like that. But anyway, so I think you can think about you want to do it with your dinner. Do you want it to be something that you sit by the crackling fire with, you know, after the presents are all open? Do you want it to be that entryway? You know, Jeff had that really good idea to talk about. How do you, you know, you're going to see a bunch of people, and how do you introduce them to mead? You know, a great time to evangelize mead. So I think about that. But anyway, going back to the first thing I was saying, I think that you are going to be around, hopefully, people you like, you know, people you love. And what is it that you want to share with them? What is it that you want to share to enhance your communion with them, your co-union with them, your experience with them? You know, what do you have that can do that? You know, what is it, whether it's a piment or a sizer or a melomel or a braggot? You know, I think about that. Think about, you know, what you can pour in the cup to enhance that experience.
Yeah.
Now, if you're not with people that, you know, maybe you're not fortunate enough to be with people you know you really care about or love, and that's an experience that happens for many people. And in that case, what I do is I get out the worst stuff that I have. I always save the B batches. But you got the worst stuff you have, because then you give it to all the people you're with that you don't like or want to be around or love. And you say, geez, I'm a home brewer. Here, try this stuff.
Try this.
And they will never ask you again for any of your stuff.
There you go.
Which is always a positive.
Oh, man. What a great time. You know, and the flip side of that, you know, talking about introducing people to meat, this might be a perfect opportunity. You know, if you are a home mead maker, if you're around people who have never had mead before, you know, getting the word out. I mean, you know, we just talked to Kevin Minster from Minnesota up there, and I mean, this dude puts out some tremendous mead. And, you know, these home mead makers, those are the guys who are really making the professional meaderies successful, because the home mead maker is going to share it with their friends, their relatives. They're going to tell other people, and pretty soon they're going to go shopping for it. And so I think this is a perfect time to introduce people to mead. You know, Jeff, if you're making something for your Christmas dinner, make sure that they know what they're drinking and how it was made.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to talk to people about the process or about your passions. I mean, and what kind of brought this on is, like I mentioned, I'm going to Thanksgiving with my in-laws this year. Usually we do Thanksgiving at my mom's house, just as a, it's just how it's worked out. But my mother-in-law wants to have a big Thanksgiving to do. And so we're going to do that. And it occurred to me while I'm thinking about what I'm going to bring for my, you know, my share of the food, that I don't think any of my in-laws have had much of anything that I've brewed maybe since our wedding back in 2015. That's a solid 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, how much have I grown as a mead maker since then? And, you know, what have they tasted then? What are they going to taste now? So yeah, I'm definitely in this thought process of, well, you know, what do I have that's really, really good? What should I bring to let people try? And, you know, I'm pulling a couple of the favorites out of the back of the mead shelf here from my own brews. Probably going to bring a bottle or two of this mulberry that I've been sipping on tonight. I've got a braggot that I made for my wife's birthday last year that is still, there's probably about 2 gallons left in this keg, that it's just gotten, you know, a little bit better and a little bit better with age. I think my father-in-law might enjoy that because, you know, he got to try a braggot at our wedding that, yeah, I don't know exactly how well he enjoyed it, but, you know, it's definitely a malty beer with some backbone that would go really nice with a turkey dinner. And then, of course, a little bit of sweet stuff too, to, you know, kind of complement that, you know, the pie at the end of the meal.
And him too. Anyway, yeah, good stuff. Good little conversation there. Let's break on into, we've got time for this one, just one deal with Facebook friends. Of course, this is where we try to answer questions with no formal expertise other than what we've experienced in our own little brew houses, both north, south, east, and west. This one, guys, I think I forwarded you the email. This comes to us all the way from Moscow, Russia. And I want to throw a big shout out to Yuri. I'm going to butcher your name, Yuri, but I think it's Kilov. If I'm not saying it right, please let me know. Yuri Kilov, he's with Self Made Brewery. He's a general director, and he's been listening to the show, guys, all the way from Russia. He says he owns and runs a small craft brewery in Moscow, Russia. They started to tap our way into Big Melomel's. He says the first two iterations were quite successful. Says he was listening to our latest podcast where Jeff touched upon fermenting mead with Kvik yeast, of all things. And I find this experiment very interesting. My question regarding this subject is, did Jeff use a purified strain of Kvik yeast or original mixed strain? Any chance to get this info? Please, kind regards, Yuri. Yuri, you came to the right place, dude. We are big, big believers in this Kvik yeast, both for beer and mead, for mead making especially. So since Jeff was the intended recipient, Jeff, I'm going to let you fire this one off. Sure. Let's start with you.
Well, my house strain around here is the Voskvik from Omega Yeast. I really enjoy it. I know Hornadal is also really popular. I've used it. I've enjoyed it. But that, the kind of a lemony, pithy flavor in combination with a lot of the fruits that I'm using, like blueberries and, you know, the cranberry in this iteration and things like that, It just appeals to me in a kind of a flavor combination way. And I've always enjoyed the way that it seems to pick up really aggressively. It ferments clean and really fast. So it's kind of just become my house strain, I guess. It's been really enjoyable for me. I highly recommend it. If you can source it, I would recommend you do so. If you can't source it in Moscow, I'd be willing to undertake an attempt to get you a package, you know, myself, honestly. International shipping can't be that terrible for one package of yeast. The thing I love about Kvake yeast is that it is, as far as I've seen, in just ridiculously reusable. You can pitch right over top of it. You can literally just dry it out and sprinkle it in there. I mean, I think we have talked about this, the survivability of this yeast strain a time or two before. At this point, I am convinced that, you know, if a nuclear bomb dropped tomorrow, the survivors would be cockroaches and Kvake yeast.
Because
this stuff is unkillable.
Yeah. Good stuff, Ryan. Kvake yeast, Yuri's asking a big question here.
My house yeast is, so his first question was, pure strain,
right,
or is it kind of a mixed culture?
Right.
And from my understanding, Omega did isolate some of the yeast, so you're not getting a lot of the multi flora culture in there. Anyway, my house strain is quickly becoming Voss, maybe Hornendahl, but it's definitely like those two. I really like playing with the Voss and the Hornendahl, and I'm not sure which one I like better, and they're both excellent. I've made ciders with it. I've made beers with it. I've made meads with it, traditionals and melomels and Breguets. I haven't made any wine with it. I mean, you could. I think that's one of the next experiments I want to do is make like a
sure.
You know, like I don't want to say low gravity wine, because I think these things can push up to like 14%. So, you should be able to make a pretty standard wine with it. Maybe you got to go a little bit lower if you need to, depending on the strain. But absolutely do that. I know that there are some other yeast manufacturers or packagers out there that do have different varieties of it. Bootleg Biology does some as well. And I think even White Labs has a Kvake yeast out there. But you can find some of these out there, and I encourage you to do that, or whatever is available in Russia. And yes, please let us know what you continue to do with that as you do it. I mean, I'm over here. I know there are guys that sell those wooden traditional. I don't know how traditional they are, but those kind of cool looking rings that we see, those wooden Kvake rings that you put on a hook in the barn in between uses, and then you just take it off the hook in the barn and throw it in the fermenter the next time you make a batch, which is definitely yeah. getting a lot of different different cultures on there. But no, I'm buying from a yeast manufacturer packager, and just kind of ripping it open and dumping it in the same way I do with any other liquid yeast. So that's the way I do it, and I love it. I almost feel like it's becoming meta to go back and use like a Belgian monastic strain or an Irish ale strain or something.
Yeah.
But that's almost becoming like the retro hipster, you know, ironic type thing to do. But I'm kind of getting, I do still have those in my arsenal. I don't at all mean to say that I'm becoming a one trick pony here. I do love the good phenolics of a Belgian strain, or the maltiness of an Irish strain, or something like that. So. Yeah. Best of luck to you, Yuri, and let us know how that stuff turns out.
Hey, Yuri, and thanks for listening. You know, like Ryan says, please let us know. Feel free to email us. And, you know, I'm going to work out a way to try to contact you somehow. I got your email address. So we're going to try to work out some kind of way to get you on the show here at the Mead House. Hey, we're going to leave it right there. Thanks for listening and for hanging out with us in this episode. And a big special thanks to our guest today, metal winning home mead maker, Kevin Mensma. I tell you, this cat makes some outstanding mead. Kevin, thanks for all you've done for Valkyrie's Horn and everything, and for sharing there during the after parties. Hey, don't forget, let us know what you're brewing. We might even give you a call. Email us at info@themeadhouse.com, or just send us a message on Facebook or Twitter, both at The Mead House. In the meantime, happy mead making and have a great Thanksgiving. That's it for this episode. Ryan, flip the lights off. Jeff, slam the door shut. We'll be back next week with episode number 145 of The Mead House. We're gone.